This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 66. And as always, thanks for listening, everybody. Very much appreciated. I'm really excited about today's show. It's something different, but also captures actually the original intent of the Radical Therapist podcast. This show kind of really, I think, captures my original vision for the podcast. That's why I'm excited about it, where we were talking, you know, we're just talking across kind of intersections of art and self-care and care work and justice seeking and all, you know, just all the intersections. So I'm really excited about today's show. We're just going to get right into it. So what's happening today, for your information, is I am meeting with Aaron Siegel from Thick Press and Gracie Obuchowicz. Gracie, sorry for doing that. So Thick Press is a co-founded by Aaron Siegel and Julie Cho. And Aaron is in DC. She's a DC-based social worker, and Julie's an LA-based graphic designer, and they midwife unusual books about care work and the work of care. And Gracie helps people transform their lives through the practice of authentic self-care, and she lives in Washington, D.C. And they came together, Thick Press and Gracie, to put together a different kind of self-help book titled Self Carefully, which is an artistic collaboration between an author, a graphic designer, printer, small press. And Self Carefully is about caring for oneself in a rocky world in the context of one's interconnectedness. And the two, Thick Press and Gracie, work closely together and kind of put together 30 topics and also interviewed three justice seekers about their leadership and self-care and action. And just, I'm going to say this up front, I'm going to there'll be links in the show notes. We should really check out this book and this press and support their work. I'm going to urge you, listeners, to support good work like this. So the links will be in, we'll talk about it towards the end of the interview, but also the links will be in the show notes. So be sure to check out their work and support their work for sure. But let's get to the interview. Without further ado, we're going to meet with Aaron and Gracie, and we're going to talk self-carefully. All right. Welcome to the Radical Therapist podcast, Aaron and Gracie.
Thanks for having us.
Yes. I'm excited. We haven't done anything art related in a while. And I think your project kind of hits all the intersections of what we hope to be on this podcast, you know, the intersections of art and therapy and on and on and on. So I'm glad you are both here, and I'm excited to introduce your press and also your work, Gracie, to our audience. And I guess I want to start maybe with Aaron. And as I understand it, Aaron, you have moved away from working in the field to establish this press, this publishing company, at the intersection of artist publishing, design, literary, nonfiction, and zines. And I'm wondering, with a focus on caregivers, justice seekers, and community builders, and I'm wondering if you can kind of give us the story of how this came about.
Yeah. So I'm a social worker. I am an old school kind of social worker through and through. I got my MSW about 20 years ago, and I'm actually still practicing just one day a week.
Okay.
I used to practice with families and children. I did early intervention and home visiting. Now I'm working with senior citizens, and I loved community-based social work, but I think there was a certain restlessness that I felt and curiosity. So decided to go get a PhD. And I think I also had some kind of desire to make things, some creativity that wasn't being fulfilled, but I don't think I realized it at the time. So I finished my PhD in 2015 and I wasn't quite sure what to do. I think academia wasn't really in the cards for me. I knew a lot of people who were doing the kind of work that your listeners and you do, you know, postmodern therapies, narrative, more dialogic work. And I was excited by research possibilities, but it was hard to find a job. So I was sort of doing adjunct teaching, was publishing for my dissertation, and I was doing dialogic group work at a senior center. And I did a storytelling group, and out of that group emerged a manuscript, and it just sort of happened. And it was kind of a multivocal manuscript. They took the voices of the different group members. They were, all of them were raised in El Salvador. So sort of a memoir. And then I found myself on vacation with an old friend. It was sort of a mom's getaway to the desert. We were in California. And we're sitting in hot springs talking, and I'm telling her about this manuscript, and she's a graphic designer. She teaches graphic design. She also practices, and her passion is books and bookmaking, book design. And we decided that we should turn it into a book, and then we didn't know where we would publish it. And then we were like, oh, well, we could publish it. And Julie, my friend, this is my partner, Julie Cho, she sort of introduced me to the whole world of book arts, artist books, chat books and poetry, artist publishing, this whole world that I really didn't know anything about. And, you know, coming from an academic setting where the peer-reviewed journal article that's just kind of on the internet was like the medium I was dealing with, I was just so excited by this idea of having a book that you could hold in your hands, that was, you know, rich with images. So we did it. And I think, I mean, this was about 2 years ago. We published our first book, which was the book I was talking about with the seniors called Recuerdos de Nuestro Pasado, but it's in English. We published that about a year ago. We have a series called Book Emerging, which is kind of more zine-like. They're photocopied. We bind them with a rubber band. We print 25. We have about five of those. And then we have Gracie's book, which I'm so excited to talk about today. That'll be the publication date now is November, but it's actually already available. I was selling it at the DC Art Book Fair a few weeks ago, and people loved it and were really excited about it.
Great. In your about page, you state that you're not really interested in critique, and this is something that caught my attention because it's something I'm thinking a lot about and writing about as well. And for me, it's asking questions like what lies beyond critique in this particular moment of our time. And I wonder if you could say a little bit more about your stance around that.
Yeah, and then I want to hear your thoughts, Chris. I want to hear what lies beyond critique at this moment. I mean, I think critique's important, especially when it comes to the oppressive social structures that are kind of at the center of our lives. I think they need to be critiqued. And I mean, I'm talking about race, class, gender, ability, sexual orientation, even age and weight, things you've talked about on the show. I think we need to critique the isms. But from a design perspective, from Julie's perspective, I think she feels like it's really important to critique work. It's how work moves forward. It's the same with therapy. When you give, you know, feedback to your supervisee, that's how they get better. But I think both of us have felt, well, first of all, we sort of felt like been there, done there, and done that, and we want to move in a different direction. But it also just hasn't felt good. Like critique, it feels constricting. It feels really constricting. And we just think there's another way, maybe a more sort of feminist way, a more collaborative way, a less hierarchical way, less top-down way, a way where maybe there's not just one answer, but there are lots of possibilities, and how do we engage with those possibilities? So that's where we are. I'm curious where you are, Chris.
Yeah, well, thanks for the question. I have a writing partner, Justine Diarrigo Patrick, and we've just did a presentation up in Vancouver recently about this idea of kind of beyond deconstruction. And so I guess I'm coming from a play. I've been influenced by some writers, and two of them in particular are Bruno Latour, and he wrote a couple of papers that were very influential, or are very influential, and how I'm looking at critique right now. And one is, why has critique run out of steam? And the other is A Compositionist Manifesto. And he has a foot in the art world as well, which is really interesting for a kind of a philosopher, but of his type. But also the work of Dr. Ana Louise Keating around post-oppositionality. And so those things have been pushing us towards what we're calling a kind of a compositionist theory. In family therapy, and it's this idea of, you know, kind of abandoning some of these tools that are no longer kind of useful or not working. It's just creating ruins upon ruins, is what Bruno Latour would say. And how do we get back to composing, rather than looking back and deconstructing kind of thing? How do we look forward and compose something, and compose a world that we can all live in, that kind of thing? And I think it relates very nicely with art as well. So that's kind of how I'm looking at it, that, you know, these tools of critique have taken us far, for sure. And like you said, I think there's, you know, we'd have to critique the isms, and critique is, I think, value. I have done art criticism, actually. I've written art criticism, and I think it's important as well for moving creativity and innovation forward. But also, I think we're losing this kind of ability to compose in particular ways. And so that's kind of how, in a nutshell, that's kind of how I'm looking at it.
I love the idea of this word compositionist, which I've never heard before.
Yeah.
I love it, and I'm going to think about it. Yeah. And I mean, for me, the act of composing a book, because that's really, especially our book Emerging, the one that we bind with a rubber band,
right. It
has three signatures. A signature is a section. And I bind it myself, and I fold it. Julie sends them from LA, and I'll, you know, I take a bone folder and fold it and then put it together. And we're wondering what, when we juxtapose three texts and there's a physical, there's a physicality to it. And we give people the books and people can take them apart and put them together in different ways.
Yeah.
What's going to come out of that? We don't know.
Right.
So for me, it's very literal and material, this idea of composing.
That's great. Yeah. Okay, and thanks for the question. I guess my next question for you is, can you, before we jump into Gracie's work, and can you tell us a bit about how you look for projects or choose authors or artists or what catches your interest, that kind of thing?
So we don't take submissions. We're really interested in collaboration and, I guess, composition. So we work with somebody from beginning to end on a project. So we'll approach people who we want to work with, and they've mostly been people who we've known through the social work world for me. But we've also kind of met people along the way at art book fairs, or we're not very active on social media, but we have met people through Instagram. And we just talk, and we have no idea what's going to emerge. We just decide that we want to work together on a particular project, and then something emerges.
That's great. Okay, Gracie. So you are the writer of the most recent release, which is titled Self Carefully. And I'm wondering if you could give us a bit about your background and how you became interested in the subject of self-care.
Whenever I talk about this, I always like to start way back, which is that I grew up in a family where people were not practicing a lot of self-care. I grew up in a family with alcoholism and undiagnosed mental illness, which I couldn't have names for that until I got older. But what I did notice as I was growing up is that I would look at other people and I knew that they were doing something and they're practicing something and they're holding themselves in this different way. And I knew I wasn't doing that and I wanted whatever that thing was. And as I grew and expanded and learned new modalities, I got a vocabulary for it, which was self-care. I started teaching yoga about 10 years ago in Washington, D.C. And doing yoga, and when I taught it, it always felt like I was getting warmer. Like it wasn't quite the thing, but it was leading me in the direction of something. And I finally was able to get a real connection to myself and have some practices that made me feel good about myself and could pick me up when I had had a bad day. And from learning about yoga, I learned about Ayurveda, which is the sister science to yoga. And it's a 5,000-year-old science that is really about well-being. So how to take care of yourself, mind, body, and spirit. And it was like, as soon as I got a taste of that, I was like, this is it. Whatever is in here, it's going to help me. And I immersed myself about 5 years ago and started to practice. And at that time, I was breaking up out of a partnership where we were living together, thought we would get married. I totally thought I would fall apart if I didn't have this person in my life, but I was doing this Ayurveda thing and making these self-care moves, and I stayed together and have been through a lot of life challenges in these past few years, including losing my father to cancer, things that I wouldn't have thought I had the skill set for, and I just kept going back to self-care. Along the way, I created a 10-week program where I wanted to teach other women about Ayurvedic daily routines. Erin was actually someone who took one of those programs, which is how we met. And what I saw was that the practicing daily routines and the inner self-care was part of it, but that there was a power in coming together as a community and being able to talk about where our self-care blocks are and support each other along the way. So I started to see that there are these three layers of self-care where it's one, these outer practices of caring for your mind and your caring for your body and exercising, sleeping, eating. Two is the inner experience of caring for your emotions and spiritual life. And then three is really about learning how to be in community in an authentic way and let yourself be supported. And I see that also as being in like the greater community of the world itself.
Great. So there's, you know, I want to maybe throw this out there. There's a critical idea out there that believes that self-care approaches often individualize systemic problems and or become just another form of wellness as consumerism. And I'm wondering how you might respond to that kind of critique.
Well, I'll address the second part first, because it's a good critique, because I do think that it's really hard to learn about self-care in our culture, because it's a culture that's based in perfectionism. It's based in the idea of self-improvement, that somehow that there's something wrong with us, and if we work really, 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 really hard, maybe we can fix some of those things, and we can be a worthy person, which I really see as the antithesis of self-care. Self-care is about a radical acceptance. Like in the moment right now, exactly as I am, I'm going to do some actions that make me feel more worthy. And the second part of that is, I don't think it's a problem to see these bigger issues in the world individualized, because I think the self is a powerful filter, that if we can't perceive what feels blocked in ourselves, like if I'm continuing to have this problem where I'm being so hard on myself, so self-critical all the time, it's important for me to understand what that's like. So when I look at the world and I see the criticism that we're heaping upon each other, I have a place to relate to that from. But I think where we get stuck is if we think it's just about making ourselves better and not seeing that we're gaining that skill set so we're able to take it out into the community and be able to not shy away from trauma when we see it in other people, because we've dealt with those places in ourselves to some extent, to not be turned off by vulnerable communities because we have a relationship with our own vulnerability. I listened to your episode on vulnerability before. I really appreciated it.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. And you just said something that kind of struck me, because I was just reading something earlier about how, you know, there's a lot of discourse around there around this individualistic critique or essentialism or something like that. We're in the post-structuralist world, I run into that critique a lot. And in some ways, I think it's detached us from our own bodies. And the way that you said that, you think it's okay to begin to maybe enter back into that individual perspective. I think there's something to that, because I think in a lot of ways, we have been detached from our own bodies.
It's 100% to me about embodiment. And I think that's where we are lost. One of the biggest distinctions I teach people in the beginning of self-care is between numbing and self-care. I think a lot of us are in these numbing practices where we do something like watching TV, eating, even getting like overly involved in the lives of other people, drinking a couple glasses of wine every night, whatever it is for you. And it, all of that's doing is it's making you feel better, but it's making you feel better because it's turning the volume down and everything. And until we can stop numbing, we don't even know what we're working with because we're not connected to our bodies. And I think once we stop the numbing, it's almost like the process leads itself because we have to pay attention. We have to get some support to work through some of those spaces and make the changes. And once that happens, I just have seen with myself and so many other people that I've worked with that there's a natural progression where we want to take on more leadership and be more service to others. But I don't see a way without getting back into the body first.
Great. Okay. So in the new book, you take a vignette style and your vignettes include topics like self-care, soaking grains, self-care in the moon, self-care and racism, self-care and consumerism, self-care and perfectionism are some of the examples. And I'm wondering if you could take us through some of these.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the reason that we did this, first of all, was that Aaron came to visit me when I think my son was 2 months old, just like totally postpartum in my house. And she said, I think I want to have this press. I want to do a book. And I like the idea, but I said, I feel really intimidated by doing this right now. And so we came up with this model that we would just have these different topics. And then I would just have to write a few words. And I actually wrote a lot of this book on my cell phone when I would take metro trips and just like put a few words on the page. So it was started as just a way that we could break this down. And I think actually turned into a great way of seeing how we can put the filter or the lens of self-care on any subject that we're looking at. So self-care, it can be an action, of course, do things that we do for ourselves. But I think self-care more than that for me is a perspective that we take where we are being able to really honor how we feel, get back into our body, connect to our own value systems, and then be able to look at anything from there. So we really wanted to have some mundane ones, like self-care and eating lunch is a good example. And that's an Ayurvedic practice that Ayurveda teaches that we have a digestive fire and that corresponds to the sun. And so when the sun is really high in the sky, we have more capacity to digest our food. And Western science backs this up in that we have more bile in our system midday than we do in the evening. And most cultures in the world eat a bigger meal midday, and generations back in the United States, we did that too. But because of our capitalist society right now, we eat more towards the end of the day because we're working. And so the lens of self-care is realizing like, wow, this actually is more natural for us to have a bigger lunch. And then within that, because I tried to do that for a long time, to eat a bigger lunch and not have a big dinner. And I found it really isolating because all my friends are getting together and having dinner and my family wanted to have big dinner. And so I realized that, okay, sometimes it's self-care for me to eat the big lunch by myself. And sometimes it's self-care for me to have the bigger dinner and just throw caution to the wind in the evening because I want more social connection. And seeing it's not an either or, but starting to just realize how my digestion works and then what my social needs are. So that's a mundane one. And then we take it really wide. Like we go to the patriarchy, we go to racism, and it's about, I think that's showing the extent of what we can do with the self-care filter of saying, okay, now you realize these things in yourself, you have this self-awareness. Now look at your community, look at what's happening in the world, look at these larger systems at play, and these things affect you. And that you know, my perspective as a white woman is very limited when I talk about a subject like racism. And yet it's really important that I talk about a subject like racism because I hold this power in our society right now. And so that section is really me talking about my limitations and the discomfort of it, and also the necessity that I do this, not just because it makes me a good person, but because it's a form of self-care for me, that if I'm not thinking about how my actions affect the whole, then my self-care isn't complete in my view.
That's great. Okay, the book also contains excerpts from 3 interviews about justice-seeking, leadership, and self-care in action, and I'm wondering if you could say more about these.
We wanted to be in conversation. So much of our planning process was about conversation, and felt like there was so much richness in the creation of this book that we couldn't quite capture in the vignettes. And so from early on, we imagined that I would go out in the world and talk to some people about what self-care actually means. So I thought of a few people from different parts of my life that were inspiring me. One is one of my clients who does a lot of work around social equity in the public school system out of Baltimore, Elsa Duré, and we had a great conversation about what it means to be a woman of color and doing the work that she does and taking on positions of leadership. One of the people I interviewed is she's a reverend and Unitarian minister who had gone back into organizing work and in the community, Louise Green, and we just had a fantastic conversation about what it means to get to a point in your life where you feel like you've made so much progress and then just have a huge setback, which was what happened when she went back into organizing and she thought it was going to be this totally idealized thing. And then like, oh crap, this is really hard. I'm like 60 years old and totally at, like in this new world. And so she was just so candid with us about what it means to pick yourself up after you've had these kind of setbacks. Mm. And the final person was Leo Davis. And he is part of a meditation group that I have led at a community homeless services program. Leo is not homeless, but he's just part of this community. And he started to come to this meditation group. And we became friends over the course of about 5 years. And every week he would kind of look at me and be like, you're doing great. You care too much about what other people think about you. He'd just give me this like critique.
Yeah.
I valued it from him. And so I just thought about him and what his presence means. And he's not organizing in any formal sense, but he's a mentor to a lot of people in his community. A lot of people, I saw how the different clients at this program would look to him and come talk to him and the space that he held. So we had a great conversation a lot about like what it means to have a spiritual life. And we really went there in that conversation. So all of them are different and all of them are about self-care and action. And I really treasure those conversations.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. Before we end, I always like to ask our guests about, you know, what books or ideas or movements, et cetera, are capturing your attention right now and what's really holding your interest. And I was wondering if you both could kind of share what you're thinking about these days.
Erin, do you want to go
well,
first?
Well, I think, Gracie, I think we should, well, I missed the conversation, but I think both of us have been very inspired by Adrienne Marie Brown and her book, Emergent Strategy. And Gracie's Self-Care Collective had a conversation about it recently. So I want to hear what your thoughts are about that these days, Gracie, since we talked about it last.
I love her work. Do you know her work, Chris?
Yeah, I am familiar with it, actually. I have her book. Yeah, I have Emergent Strategy.
And I haven't read her new one yet, but I just love the name of it, Pleasure Activism.
Yeah, right.
And she talks a lot about getting back into the body and what that means as a sustainable form of activism. We read it within the community of women I work with around self-care and social justice. And it was one of those conversations that it opened up a lot more than it closed. But just really talking about what it means to be creating this different way of doing it. Like, I think we have this very, like, I'm for this and I'm against this. And we get into this back and forth that can feel really limiting. And I think her work opens up a different way of looking at, like, how we can put the self back into this work. And that, like we were saying before, that using ourself in the way that we treat ourselves and the way that we're in relationship with other people is a fractal to look at how these bigger systems are breaking down or being built up. And that if we can make changes within our own self, that can have a ripple out effect to the larger realms as well.
Yeah, it's funny, going back to my compositions paper that I'm writing with Justine, we actually started with a quote from Adrienne Marie Brown that goes, "Don't ask me anything you could find in a book or on the internet. Start talking at the edge of what's known," which we think is really great. But anything else capturing your attention? Or
I'm always so inspired by the Justice Democrats right now. Yeah. Like, it's just such a moment to watch these, especially the four that are really in the news right now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ilhan Omar, just to see people embody so much for so many people and really take a very strong stance against what I see as a lot of tyranny that's happening right now, and do it in such a way where it doesn't feel like they're disconnected from themselves. But to me, it feels like it transcends politics in a lot of ways. It's really about like taking a values-based look at leadership and how to not sacrifice yourself just to play by the rules.
Yeah. And I think the reason they're getting so much blowback is because they're actually pointing, you know, at the larger systems at play. And they're seeing the response to that. So, and they're the courageousness of that. I think a lot of times, I'm sorry for my rant, but a lot of times justice efforts get pointed at each other and in particular ways, whereas they're just doing a wonderful job of making visible how the system's working. And that's not okay with a lot of people, and you're seeing it happen. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, it's hard to watch what's happening and what they have to take on, but also it's inspiring to see that, that they can be at the level that they're at and get the attention that they're getting.
Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. So, before I let you go, how do people find you? How do they buy the book? How do they, support the press and support your work?
So the book right now, it's available from our website, which is www.thickpress.com. And I realized we haven't described the book. And Chris, we sent you a copy.
Yes, you did. It's beautiful.
I would love it's printed. It's risograph printed. Mm-hmm. A risograph, it looks like a copy machine, but it kind of mimics silk printing. And very, very involved in our process was Maria Habib, who is a good friend of Gracie's and a graphic designer and an illustrator. And every page just has these, how would you describe it, Chris?
Every page has, unique artwork, and it's just beautifully put together. I think you have a limited run, right? Is there a limited run?
We're printing 500, and then our printer, whose name's Erica Veteran, she's willing to do another 500.
Okay, so there's 500 available, but another 500 could be printed.
Yeah, that's sort of the plan for now. We're taking it slowly, seeing how things develop. So it's available from our website. The publication date is November. Then it will be available from our distributor, which is a Berkeley-based nonprofit distributor called Small Press Distribution. And we'll see where it ends up once it's in their hands.
Okay. Great. Okay. And Gracie, how would they find you? And if people have questions, et cetera.
Yeah. You can go to my website. It's selfcarewithgracie.com. And Gracie is spelled G-R-A-C-Y. I have a podcast called Self Care with Gracie. And I also do a every other week newsletter on Wednesdays where I talk about whatever my self-care filter is on or whatever kind of reader questions or feedback I'm getting that week, and how to just, it's meant to help people hone their self-care filter. So just to stay in the energy of it. And I get that feedback a lot of like, just reading your newsletters helps me to just remember that self-care is something I have to think about and that it is important.
That's great. And audience, I will link all of that on the show notes, so you'll be able to access it too. So, Aaron and Gracie, I want to say thank you for making the time and sharing your work with us, and keep doing the good work.
Thanks so much, Chris.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
It's been great.
Well, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening and thanks for supporting. And there's other ways you can support this work. For sure, go buy that book. But also, if you could support the podcast, if you could rate and review the show on iTunes, that would be awesome. And go find us on social media. We're all over. The Radical Therapist is on Instagram. We're on Twitter at The Rad Therapist. Facebook, we have a Radical Therapist Facebook page. Go check that out. And you can always email me at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. And I owe some people some emails. I'm going to get to them, I promise. Looking for shirts and stickers. And I do have those. So if you listened this long into the podcast, hit me up. I got shirts. I got stickers. So just let me know. Anyway, so that's our show. And as always, I'm Dr. Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist. And thanks for listening.